This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Books. This Mother's Day, give mom her flowers. She deserves the best. That's why you should send her farm fresh flowers from Books. That's short for bouquets. And right now you can get 25% off your entire Books purchase. Here's why everyone likes the Books company. Books is different. Their flowers are cut fresh and sourced directly from the best flower farms, so they can last way longer. They even have flowers grown on the side of a volcano. Wow. Books has modern designs and unique flowers you can't find anywhere else. Books is simple. You go online, pick the delivery date, and you're done. Mother's Day is May 12th. Don't miss the chance to thank your mom. Order your Books now. And with 20% off, you can send some to mom, wife, aunt, and even grandma. I am very happy that I'm reading this ad because now I'm remembering when Mother's Day is. And I'm going to order a whole bunch of Books because they're fantastic flowers. Go to Books.com and use promo code Crooked for 25% off. That's Books.com. Promo code Crooked. Books promo code Crooked. Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm John Favreau.
I'm the ex, formerly known as John Lovett.
There we go.
Tommy Vitor.
On today's show, Donald Trump is still crushing the field in a pair of Iowa and South Carolina polls that officially qualify multiple candidates for the first debate. The DeSantis campaign has finally landed on a let Ron be Ron strategy.
I don't know if I said it
on the podcast or somewhere else in life, but we've definitely been saying it. Joe Biden's campaign builds an unconventional operation to take on the Republican nominee. And later, New York Congressman Dan Goldman stops by to chat with Tommy about prosecuting Donald Trump and the latest House Republican antics around Hunter Biden and RFK Jr.
If you send a direct message on Twitter, is it a DMX? I think that's important to think about.
Did you see that Microsoft and Meta have the trademark for X?
I did.
So X literally not going to give it to you.
Love it so meta.
Can we talk about some news?
But first, no third indictment just yet. Although by the time you hear it, who knows? By the time you hear this.
Let's go, Jack.
Though Judge Aileen Cannon did set a trial date for Trump's second indictment, the Republican frontrunner is scheduled to stand trial on May 20th, 2024 for stealing highly classified documents from the White House. Trump's volume of deranged truths has also picked up considerably over the last 48 hours, so maybe something's coming there. He's now sharing posts that accuse the government he led of staging the January 6th attack on the Capitol. He also made a threat on an Iowa radio show last week that if he's convicted and imprisoned, his fans might do something even worse.
Is it something that concerns you of the people making sure that they don't go out of their right mind if something like that happens? Because I know what I'm thinking of could happen if that, for example, they do say Jack Smith says, okay, I'm going to put Donald Trump in jail.
I think it's a very dangerous thing to even talk about, because we do have a tremendously passionate group of voters. And I mean, maybe 100, 150. I've never seen anything like it. Mm-hmm. Much more passion than they had in 2020 and much more passion than they had in 2016. I think it would be very dangerous.
Where's the 100 and 150 come from? I just noticed.
Yeah, what's that count from?
I also like the question is, are you concerned? Are you concerned? He's really concerned, you can tell. So his message here, Trump's message here is that the insurrection was a false flag operation that could also happen again if he's held accountable for breaking the law. You guys think we'll hear that defense from his lawyers in court?
Yeah, and it's just, I think it's worth noting that this conspiracy theory that that January 6th was a false flag operation, that the sort of a FBI plant led everyone to charge the Capitol has been around for a while. And a guy named Ray Epps, who is a former member of the Oath Keepers militia, had to sell his house and move because he was getting threats from other crazy right-wing people who suggested he was some sort of FBI plant. He is absolutely not. There's no evidence to to prove any of this, but Trump and Steve Bannon and all these guys have latched onto it to push this false flag narrative. And it's very scary.
Yeah, two thoughts. One, if you cannot call that, you can't call this a strategy of any kind. But if it is, it is not a legal one. It is just a thrashing PR campaign to sort of excite the base and keep Republicans in the fold. But what's striking about it to me is, you know, one thing we've noticed over the years about all these different attorneys who've been involved in sundry Trump investigations is they become so radicalized in favor of prosecution. Like, you see it out of the people that came out of Mueller, you see it out of all these different investigations. And I just think, you know, you're working on this case. There have been death threats against prosecutors. You're working day and night looking at this brazen and ridiculous illegal activity by the former president of the United States. Is it all worth it? Should I fight again tomorrow? And then you turn on the television and he's learned nothing. He's doing it even more.
And you just get a Subway and you call it a day.
Yeah.
Get some food.
Get a tuna foot long.
Look, I just don't think it necessarily helps his case to argue that the violent attack was a secret FBI operation, but also threatened that his supporters may do it again if he's convicted.
Yeah, it's
it was an FBI plant, but also they might do it again. And this whole, it's like he's had so many different, this is where he's going to have some issues when this indictment comes down. He's had so many different explanations for January 6th. Like, on June 22nd of this last year, he said January 6th was not a simple protest. It was not a simple protest. It represented the greatest movement in the history of our country to make America great again. I had forgotten that he said that.
Well,
and spot the lie.
It's very similar to the conversation he has with Brett Baer. You know, he goes on, he basically does like improv excuses and lies and justifications, but every single one would require a different fact pattern. Every single one is something a prosecutor can ask him at a trial. So every day he goes out and makes whatever defense attorney is still answering the phones lives difficult, more difficult every single day. And even, you know, he's getting on the phone with like Stefanik and McCarthy trying to strategize how the House investigations can help him run interference. None of that is going to make his legal arguments any stronger. None of that has anything to do with the actual threat he faces from the justice system.
I think it's very scary and it's clearly a threat. But I think the good news is this, like some of the hardcore MAGA types have been out there saying to the other supporters, do not go to these protests. Do not back him. Do not get violent, because he hung us all out to dry on January 6th and didn't pardon those people.
And sure enough, there was a pretty small, relatively small crowd outside the courthouse when he was indicted for the second time.
Look, it only takes one person.
For sure.
But
for
yeah,
sure.
At the height of his powers while in the White House in a violent cause that was explicitly about keeping him in power, not protecting him in front of a courthouse, not stopping him even long before he could ever become president. What was mustered? It was a violent attempt to overthrow the government. It hurt a lot of people. It caused a lot of damage, but he's got chaos and mayhem support. He doesn't have, there's no revolution.
Mm. What do you guys make of the May 2024 trial date for the classified documents indictment?
So here's why I think Trump was truthing so angrily. I think he just figured out what his next year is like.
It's a rough calendar.
It's October 2nd, New York civil fraud trial. January 15th, second E. Jean Carroll civil defamation trial.
Also the day of the Iowa caucuses.
Also the day of the
Don't forget.
It's a big one. Yeah.
March 25th, Manhattan hush money trial. May 20th, the classified documents trial out of Florida. That there
and
was also,
we still and, got, we still got, two
we've got Jack Smith,
left.
We got Jack Smith in DC, we got the Georgia case.
Yep.
So he's got his, he's heading out on his Trump's legal heirs tour.
Yeah, you know, he's got like a wedding or two also, right?
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's got a couple weddings.
Yeah, everyone's got that. He's got to fit in with this thing. I mean, this is a terrible
he's probably
year.
Gonna DJ a few weddings
right.
at Mar-a-Lago himself.
Right. He's booked.
I mean, he's
booked
and busy.
I know he's a DJ now.
Look, forget that he was president, forget everything else. This is a man about to face six independent trials.
You know, I was thinking this the other day.
So
I'm like,
annoying.
Forget about, like, yeah, presidents, yeah. politicians. Has anyone faced this many
Six trials?
For separate crimes.
Good for question. Separate crimes, yeah.
For I mean, separate crimes in a year?
Like, I assume there's been,
be,
like...
We gotta call Guinness. This is like a... It's getting up. It's a record.
Like, I don't know how many of the Enron people, but, like this is wild.
So Jack Smith wanted December of 2023. Trump's lawyers wanted never. I guess technically they said they wanted the postpone indefinitely, but certainly after November 2024. Cannon landed in May. But of course, it could still be postponed from May 20th.
Seems guess, very likely it'll be postponed
due to pre due to Perfect. It's and due to it says routine pretrial motions, right?
The amount of, so according to the New York Times, the amount of discovery evidence that Trump's lawyers have to go through will include more than 1 million pages of unclassified material, 9 months of surveillance camera footage, and 1,500 pages of classified documents. So yeah,
they better get to work.
It's going to take a minute.
I wouldn't save that to the last minute.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I think, rightful concern that the fact that it landed in Cannon's courtroom was nerve-wracking for people that assume she would do everything she can to help Trump. We don't know yet if what's going to actually unfold, like what she can do. She still has a lot of power. You know, she set this date. Maybe it's a date set so that she can postpone it again. Who knows? But when you see these three other cases and the fact that there are two more coming down the pike, you start to see that he's going to need a lot more help. The other piece of it is you look at like the primary schedule, and we don't know when the Jack Smith or the Georgia cases could land, but it does seem like what we're heading towards is a period of time in which, while Trump is running for the nomination, he has the microphone. Mm. He gets to describe it to voters. He gets to talk over his opponents. He gets to continue to define January 6th and his various legal troubles to his adoring fans. But then all of a sudden, perhaps after he has put himself on a path to be the nominee, then the trials begin. And then Trump no longer, Trump's approval rating never dropped faster or harder than during the insurrection because he could not overcome the video, the visuals that were coming out of what took place. And now all of a sudden, he can talk all he wants, but trials look like trials, and they have a rhythm all their own.
Look, it's very possible that Republicans nominate someone who will be a convicted felon by the time November 2024 comes around.
It could happen between him getting enough delegates in the convention. Yeah. Like it could happen in those months.
And in that, that scenario, it's possible if they were a sane party that Republicans could try to wrest the nomination from him at the convention. But who are we kidding?
Look,
they're moving forward. And this is only like, it is interesting that the March date for the, I keep forgetting about the Stormy Daniels one. So that trial could take a couple weeks and could get a guilty verdict there by April or May. In May, if Cannon doesn't move it, you know, that's still like 2-3-4 week trial.
I think like they said like 6 weeks is probably the minimum for that trial. So it's pre-convention, which means it does mean the party has time to remove him as the nominee. You're not officially nominated until I think July 18th is the final day of the Republican convention. It won't happen.
We are not that lucky. This is just, not forget about that, just to see the fight. How fun would the fight be?
It would be a great fight.
Here's the thing, but like, I think what I'm taking away from seeing all these different trials unfolding is, I don't know how lucky we have to be. That's the first, the other piece
Law
of this
of averages,
too is, yeah, but the other part of it too is, once you add the Jack Smith case, you add the Georgia case, and even if the trial, one of them slips, we're still staring at a spring, summer, and fall where potentially the dominant issue in front of voters is the most unsavory and unpopular position Trump has ever taken, which is, I don't really support democracy. It'll become central to the campaign. You know, those images side by side, Trump on trial for insurrection and Biden campaigning, I don't know, on a road, you know, with a road and a shovel. That's pretty good.
Some candidates do like Medicare Advantage plan rollouts or foreign policy speeches. Donnie's doing indictments and perp walks. Those are his message events.
You think there'll be a step and repeat behind him outside the courtroom?
Well, which court?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because they're all going to want their own branding.
He's gonna
One is, any swing state court? Yeah, I guess the Georgia, he could spend time campaigning.
Oh wow, he can really make sure his schedule
is
two birds.
Commit a Wisconsin crime next time, you idiot.
Also, Trump's got a new lawyer said he wants... Trump wants cameras in the courtroom. It could just be something to say because he knows that they probably won't allow cameras in the courtroom. And then they'll say, oh, Trump wanted it. He wanted people to see what was going on there. That'd be how great would that be?
They just watched that great new show, Jury Duty.
The cameras in the courtroom ideas. Would be, for this try, would be amazing.
Yes, please.
How do you
please.
Do in the classified documents? That's all confusing.
That's why it's going to be
really
tough.
That one's tough.
So, most of Trump's primary opponents still refuse to entertain the idea that he may have broken the law by attempting a coup. And some are even pretending that January 6th wasn't really an insurrection. Here's Tim Scott, Mike Pence, and Ron DeSantis.
I hold the folks who broke into the Capitol with ill will in their hearts, destroying property, responsible for their actions. I don't hold the former president who didn't show up at the Capitol and threatened my life as responsible.
While his words were reckless, based on what I know, I'm not yet convinced that they were criminal. President Trump was wrong on that day, and he's still wrong. in asserting that I had the right to overturn the election. But what his intentions were, and as you know, criminal charges have everything to do with intent, what the president's state of mind was. And I don't honestly know what his intention was that day.
It was not an insurrection. These are people that were there to attend a rally, and then they were there to protest. Now, it devolved, and it devolved into a riot. But the idea that this was a plan to somehow overthrow the government of the United States is not true, and it's something that the media had spun up. If somebody is honestly doing an insurrection against the U.S. government, then prove that that's the case, and I'll be happy to accept it.
Well, they've proved it many times. That's why they're all in fucking jail.
That is just wild.
The most galling part of that is Mike Pence saying he didn't know what Trump's intentions were. Yeah, you did, dude. You talked to him. You're one of the very few people who got to talk to him.
Yeah, his intentions were that he tried to kill you.
Yeah, well, you just don't have the guts to share what you learned.
Well, also remember, for some reason, this made me think of the Kevin McCarthy phone call. Remember, McCarthy calls Trump in the middle of the attack, and he's like, they're trying to kill me. And then Donald Trump's like, well, Kevin, I guess they're angrier about the results of the election than you are, huh? Yep. And then he's like, they're fucking trying to kill me. They all knew what the intention was.
They all knew what. And also, the Jack Smith case is not about just January 6th, the day. It's about the sprawling effort to overturn the election. But what we just heard there, to me, is a story. It's like compounding political cowardice, right? Like, McConnell wouldn't impeach. You just talked about the Kevin McCarthy phone call. Right after that, he said that Trump bears responsibility, that Congress should censure him. And then he went crawling back down to Mar-a-Lago to kiss the ring when he realized he needed Trump to get the votes to be speaker. So now here we are in a 2015-style conundrum where none of Trump's opponents will actually attack him for leading an insurrection because they all are trying to like win some sliver of his voters by taking oblique shots or running to the right of him on policy. And it's failing miserably.
How about hopeful, optimistic candidate Tim Scott setting the bar at, well, he didn't come try to kill me personally at the Capitol, I do not hold him responsible.
Now,
who doesn't try to murder me, it's okay.
I would like to say, in defense of Senator Tim Scott, and
hey, Tim Scott spin zone over here.
Yeah, the
it's Timmy time.
Guys, buckle your seatbelts because we're on a rocket ship. But the check out those IO polls. We'll get to it, but
we're gonna get to that.
But feel the G-forces.
Okay.
Feel the G-forces. Okay. But he does say as responsible.
Now, here's the sad part of the question.
That means he's responsible.
They clearly think this is the only way they can win the Republican nomination, those three, if they genuinely think they can win the Republican nomination, which I presume they still do, which because they're spending all this time on the race. Are they right?
No. Let's talk about that Iowa poll. Because I think that tells the story. Like, there's a new Iowa poll out. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I assume John does in his intro to this segment.
Sure. We got Trump
46.
Trump 46, Ron DeSantis 16, Tim Scott 11, Vivek Ramaswamy 6, and Nikki Haley 5.
So this is the Tim Scott rocket ship. He's in double digits in Iowa.
That's two digits. Twice. We've doubled in digits, baby.
But it seems clear to me that all of the support that's going to Tim Scott and others is coming from Ron DeSantis. No one is chipping away Trump here. He's still doing great.
Yeah.
So no, it's not working. They're fighting each other just like 2015.
It's definitely not working, for sure. But when you look at the polls of how Republican voters feel about January 6th, 32% of Republican voters approve of what happened on January 6th. So that's fortunately low.
That's a lot.
That's unfortunately. I mean, I'm going to get to something worse.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Only 14% of Republicans describe Trump as very responsible for January 6th, compared to 45% of all voters. This was a Politico poll from earlier this year. They did a bunch of polls around the anniversary, and then they haven't done any since on January 6th. I'm sure we'll get more soon. In total, only 31% of Republican voters said Trump was very or somewhat responsible for January 6th, even though 59% of all voters assigned that level of responsibility to Trump. Q poll from December, only 9% of Republicans think Trump's attempt to overturn the election was a crime. 81% say it wasn't criminal.
And it's worth noting, too,
just
that
brutal.
Since that the numbers have slowly shifted, and it depends on how you ask the question, but roughly two-thirds of Republicans believe that the election wasn't legitimately decided at this point. They sort of have bought into this, and it's sort of part of the hallmark of this era, which is when someone like Ron DeSantis is asked that question, is he saying what he believes that the base of the party also believes? Or is he doing a shibboleth and signaling to them that he's not going to give in to the mainstream narrative because he understands that we're all in this fight together to protect, to protect Trump or whatever it may be, because none of us can really, we can't tell these.
Is there a difference?
There isn't a difference. There isn't a difference in practice, but I do think it's like, it's right, because he's not saying, this is what I believe. He's saying, look at how I fight.
I just think it's all a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, no one believes the thing I won't make an argument for. Well, of course not. Now, yeah. Am I saying that I would make this the thrust of my campaign if I were running against Trump? Absolutely not. I'd probably answer honestly and as briefly as I could. And then to the extent this is part of my argument, it would be, to me, about electability. Like, look, most of the country blames this guy for the insurrection. That's the last image they saw of him as president. That's why he can't win. Like, that's what I would do. But yeah, I mean, I get
totally
the challenges.
Could do that. That would have been a great answer.
Well, like, when no one's fighting, no one's making a case.
Not that I want him to give that answer, but
it's, no one's softening the ground. It's like, it's rock solid.
It's another collective action issue too, because like all these Republican politicians in private would probably say, this is what the base thinks. Look at these poll numbers, right? But where do you think Republican voters take their cues from? They take their cues from the leaders of the party and from the people that the idiots that they see on TV who are also lying about this shit. Mm-hmm. So if that's all they ever hear, of course these polls are going
to
be.
They can also look at Chris Christie, who has been out there trying to make the argument. And what's happened? Trump's numbers hasn't moved. His numbers haven't moved. The only thing that's happened is more and more Republicans, when asked the question, say that he's an unpalatable candidate, the only person they couldn't vote for.
Yeah, but he's rising in the polls a little bit too.
Yeah, I mean, he's not Tim Scott, but he's doing okay.
He's only a couple points behind Tim Scott. Well, so as Tommy pointed out, whatever the other candidates are doing, it doesn't seem to be working. We heard the Iowa poll from Fox. There is also a South Carolina poll that they released. That's Trump 48, Haley 14, DeSantis 13, Scott 10, Mike Pence 4. Notice I didn't mention Mike Pence in the Iowa poll because he was under Nikki Haley and Vivek Ramaswamy at 6-5. So these results from these two polls officially qualify Trump, DeSantis, Haley, Ramaswamy, Scott, and Chris Christie for the first debate a month from now. Mike Pence and Doug Burgum insist they'll qualify, but they haven't yet. Pence hasn't yet because he doesn't have the donors yet, though he does have the polls. And Burgum has the donors, but he doesn't yet have the polls.
It's weird that you need the donors and the polls. Why wouldn't you just need the polls? I don't know.
That's a good question. I guess because polls are like, it's hard to trust polls and like... donors are like real actual people. Like,
yeah, I guess it's the sign maybe of some sort of enthusiasm.
No,
yeah,
I think the incentive structure has really, it's a mess. Clearly has fucked up.
Yeah, because Doug Burgum is just buying donors at $20 a pop. So
for sure.
Right. What do you guys make of these polls? So 30-point lead in Iowa with 6 months to go. What do you think, Tommy?
I want to tell you my favorite part of this poll is that we'll talk about the debate later, but Fox slipped in a question about what you think it means for a presidential candidate to skip the debate. 59% said shows a candidate's weakness rather than strength, 27%. That's just hilarious that Fox is like, we're hosting the first debate. Don't you think it's weak if you skip it?
Also, though, how cowardly to phrase the question like that instead of saying, what do you think about Trump skipping the debate?
Right, which probably would have gotten a totally
different
answer.
Right, because they wouldn't have got it that much.
Right, would have flipped it.
I think both these polls show Trump is in very firm lead and that Ron DeSantis is hemorrhaging support. And I think there's room for other people to have these little mini boomlets. But it's humiliating for Mike Pence, like you said. 4 in 10 voters in the Iowa poll said they couldn't support him at all, ever. I mean, that is just devastating. He's done.
Trump gets... the education divide was, per usual, in the Republican Party and in the electorate, the starkest in both these polls. Trump in Iowa gets 57% of those without a college degree, only 33% of voters with. And the challenge for all these other candidates is, within the Republican electorate, it's just an electorate that is more non-college educated than it is college educated. And that is especially true in a state like Iowa. It is especially true in South Carolina. It's not as true in New Hampshire, which is why that's probably, of the three states, Trump's worst state currently, even though he's still kicking ass. Trump's other best groups, voters under age 35, it's interesting that young people are one of his best groups, very conservative voters and voters who rarely attend religious services, though in South Carolina, white evangelicals are one of his strongest groups. So it's one of those things where across all categories, religious, not religious, old, young,
he's winning.
On the young front, it's a self-selecting group of people. The kind of young people that are Republicans in the state of Iowa are going to be a pretty conservative bunch. But it actually more points to the other problem a lot of these candidates have, which is at least in 2016, there was a lane for going after more conservative and evangelical voters. But this poll found that across Iowa and South Carolina, the evangelical numbers track the main polling number.
Yeah.
The biggest issue that people care about, though, in the Iowa one was defeating Joe Biden and not on issues, which again makes you wonder, hey, Ron DeSantis, why are you running to the right of Trump on all these random issues instead of going after his electability, you moron?
Well, this is why it's like wild. That the only sin that has turned Republicans against Trump over the years has been the sin of him not being electable, the sin of him losing. And the fact that they're not saying that these indictments are a sign that he can't win, that no one's making that argument. Even DeSantis, after his reboot, we'll get to it, but he's not even making that argument.
They are advancing Trump's message, right? By saying that, like, even though they're trying to say, well, I'm just focused on the weaponization of the Justice Department and the two-tiered system. That's Trump's message. That's Trump's central message about his indictments. Here's where you're going to get excited, Lovett. Tim Scott. Most opportunity to grow in Iowa. Only 12% say they'd never back him, which is the lowest of the major candidates. 90% are open to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he is drawing from a wide range of demographics. So he's drawing from moderates and from very conservative.
Here's the thing. Everybody loves Tim Scott. Tim Scott loves
everyone except for like the 80s, 90% who's backing the other.
They don't dislike Tim Scott. They just have two great options.
People like Tim Scott.
Options.
I think a quarter of them said they didn't know enough about him to make a decision.
To think about the privilege of being an Iowa Republican where you can choose between people as great as Trump and Scott, right? With DeSantis as your third choice, how cool is that? How cool is that? It's like there's like a Chili's, a Cheesecake Factory, and an Olive Garden right there at the side of the road.
We were talking about this earlier before we started recording, but it is interesting to me that in South Carolina, DeSantis has slipped to third, but it's not because Scott's in second, it's because Haley's in second. My guess is that she was got a very popular governor there, and people know their governors a little bit more better than they know their senators, but that's my only guess.
She also launched her campaign first. She had a bunch more events there, so who knows?
Yeah. So Trump aides said to the Washington Post over the weekend, it's unlikely he's going to change his mind about skipping the first debate, despite pleas from his favorite Fox hosts, and not just privately, they're doing it on the air apparently.
So pathetic.
I know, in addition to those polling questions that Tommy mentioned. What do you guys think are the political dynamics of a debate without Trump that it seems like we are careening towards?
Don't you imagine that he'll just hold his own big event and counter-program it and try to steal all of their thunder?
I think they've threatened that, and they said like maybe he might sit down with Tucker for Tucker's show to counter-program.
Not a show on X.
Yeah.
Well, the point Trump made is, why would I do the debate? I'll just increase the ratings.
Yeah.
And then Fox is playing into that argument by being like, please come do the debate. We need the ratings.
And then he's smart enough to know that he'll just watch a bunch of B-team candidates attack each other instead of him and look like the B-team.
And like, and Ramaswamy and Chris Christie have been out there being like, Trump's afraid to debate us if he's such a strong...
Oh, Ramaswamy's been saying that too.
Yeah, Ramaswamy said it as well. Ramaswamy said it in the best way. He said, it looks like Trump might be afraid. I sure hope not. Doesn't seem like him. Something like that.
He could be a surprise, like, quote-unquote star of the debate without Trump on the stage, because that guy doesn't have much to lose, and he's just sort of swinging for the fences. I'm interested to see, like, how much time Christie spends going after Trump. Does Christie also try to light up DeSantis? Does anyone else try to light up DeSantis if Trump's not there, because he's still number two and you might as well go after him? Like, what happens?
I think Christie not only goes after Trump, but calls out everyone else for not having the courage to go after Trump. Which we'll see how that goes.
Yeah,
and then what happens? And then do they just like pivot, or do they defend?
Someone defends.
Defend
it.
Trump,
absolutely.
And that's so embarrassing.
Yeah, I don't. Well, like if Ramaswamy wasn't on the stage, you would think, all right, this debate is Chris Christie versus everybody else, and he's going to make that case against them. But with Ramaswamy there, he's sort of like a chaos agent, and then you have to think, DeSantis, Haley, Scott. Someone up there is going to come with a plan that is ready for what to do when Chris Christie does that kind of a broadside against the whole field and take it. But I don't know if it can be. It can't just be defend Trump. So you have to think Ron DeSantis has to do a version in front of the debate audience of the argument for basically, you know, get things done, Trump without the chaos. He has to kind of make that case. And that's the question is how hard he does it.
I think you just go with like the Ronald Reagan 11th commandment, thou shalt not attack other Republicans bullshit that everyone's used to, and coming together for unity and beating Joe Biden. Yeah.
I could see Tim Scott and Doug Burgum doing that too. Doing
the Berg.
There's a lot of fighting up here, but I think we're fighting too much and we need to look forward. Blah, blah, blah.
I can't see Doug Burgum doing much of anything. So I honestly, if he was right here, I wouldn't.
He is here. He's been here. He's sitting quietly.
Yeah, because he's dropping off our gift cards.
Yeah. We should actually, honestly, we should bankrupt Doug Burgum. We should all take the $20 and donate the dollar. Why are we doing that?
I mean, great idea. I know. Pod Save America is brought to you by Fast Growing Trees. Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the U.S.?
I know now.
There you go. They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you. Find the perfect fit for your climate and space. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days.
And that's so fast.
So fast. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation forever. Let me tell you, I'm not very good at keeping plants alive, but they sent us a little tree, and it is...
a ficus.
It is both alive and thriving.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Big, beautiful leaves.
Big leaves. Big leaves. I love the looks of it. Looks great. It came really fast. Perfect. This spring, they have the best deals online, up to half on select plants and other deals, and listeners to our show get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code Cricket at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code Cricket at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code Cricket. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How do you cope when there's something weighing on you or something you need to get off your chest? You know the best way to do it? Best way to cope is to talk about it. Not just cram it down. Not do what generations of New Englanders have done. Just stuff their feelings down. Maybe cover it with a coat of booze. No. You got to talk to someone, you got to work it out, get it off your chest. And just by doing that, you will feel better. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/PSA. Go today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/PSA.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware. Shop chef quality pots and pans at madeincookware.com.
So DeSantis slipping to third place for the first time in that South Carolina poll is just one of the many shitty headlines for his campaign lately. Lots of stories about shakeups and reboots over the weekend that have all the campaign classics. We got a donor telling Politico it's time to let Ron be Ron. We got a new media strategy that they're calling DeSantis is everywhere.
Ugh, it's a threat.
We got the campaign.
Like something you have to clean up.
The campaign blowing through cash on private planes and fancy hotels. We got infighting between the campaign and the super PAC. Meanwhile, the campaign briefly retweeted another bizarre video over the weekend that ends with a neo-Nazi symbol superimposed on a Florida flag. And the candidate spent the weekend threatening to sue Bud Light for sending a beer to a trans person. And he tried to explain a line in his state's new education curriculum that reads this. Quote, instruction includes how slaves developed skills which, in some instances, could be applied for their personal benefit. Here's DeSantis' response to that curriculum, followed by a fiery denunciation from Vice President Kamala Harris.
These are the most robust standards in African American history, probably anywhere in the country. I think that they're probably going to show some of the folks that eventually parlayed being a blacksmith into doing things later in life.
How is it that anyone could suggest that in the midst of these atrocities, that there was any benefit to being subjected to this level of dehumanization?
So it seems like the DeSantis reboot is off to a strong start, huh? Of all of these DeSantis imploding stories and details, of which there were many to comb through, which do you guys think are most politically consequential and which are just fun to mock?
I mean, I do think we like this comment he made about slavery is one of the dumbest, most offensive, like straight out of the lost cause revisionist history narrative things that I've ever heard a politician do. I know, obviously, it was his Board of Education, but they did it because of his stupid Stop Woke Act. And it's just worth saying that even the examples that the Florida Department of Education held up as individuals who benefited from slavery, many of them were never enslaved. One of them was a poet and a writer. Not a lot of slaves were taught how to read and write during slavery. So it's just like, it's outrageous on its face. It's frankly why critical race theory gets taught in the first place. So I do think it's just worth putting a stamp on what Kamala Harris said there and like explaining how outrageous this is.
I also want to say about that too, there's a lot of pro-DeSantis pundits on X. arguing about how this was out of context. And they're like, look at the whole curriculum. Look at the... And it's like, yes, the entire curriculum does explicitly call for kids to learn about the many horrors of slavery. But still, why do you include that line? Why does anyone need to be taught that, oh, there were some skills that were useful later on? Why else would you teach that if not for
it's apology.
Yeah, it's to apologize for it. There were some silver linings.
It's also bullshit. Again, his example is a blacksmith. Like, people across Africa knew how to forge iron and other metals before slavery. You know, the famous bronze statues that the British looted and took them to their museums, those were created in the 16th century.
It also doesn't matter if you picked up a fucking skill while you were being raped and tortured and dehumanized. It doesn't matter.
It's wrong. It's offensive.
Listen,
outrageous.
I think I just want to add my two cents to this, which I also believe slavery was morally reprehensible
indefensible
completely.
Here we are.
And as you know, Will Hurd, who's almost at 1% some of these polls, just made the point simply, which is no, slavery was not a jobs program, Ron, yeah. Which I thought was pretty good.
Chris Christie also tagged him for it.
It's just, it's incredible.
But I do think that like, this is part of like, DeSantis thought that this anti-woke thing was his ticket to being like the Republican standard bearer, the person that could replace Trump, his way into the hearts of like the kind of rabid base of the party. But he keeps getting dragged into these ridiculous and embarrassing and extremist controversies that make him seem unelectable and undermines his main argument, his main thrust for why he could beat Trump.
Yeah. He made his bet here.
Yeah, like this another crazy sort of doomer edgelord video that had the Nazi symbol at the end. Like all of this shit that the curriculum, the New York Times had a little detail that the homophobic / homoerotic ad was actually made by a DeSantis staffer.
Made in house. Yeah.
Yeah, made in house. All these things, like, I think deeply hurt him in a general election. should he ever get there?
Just too online. And of course, in your too online, too bubbly right-wing campaign, of course your young video staffers are the most online of them all,
right?
Making this absolutely incomprehensible and hateful fucking gibberish that you're spreading on the internet because it makes you and a few other Reddit trolls fucking laugh.
Yeah, and like this narrative generally that his campaign is a mess and out of control, it's just a massive distraction. And it's infecting everything they do. And as Dan said, the media wants a blood sacrifice. They want like the campaign manager fired. It doesn't like look like Ron is ready to do that. But his whole argument was like, hey guys, I'm Trump, but I'm competent. You know, I can execute.
Look no what chaos,
I
did in Florida. No baggage. It's like,
you can't run your own campaign. And the profligate spending, I mean, they were having some donor retreat. They held it at something called the Stein Erickson Lodge in Deer Valley. We're recording this on Monday, July 24th. The cheapest room available tonight is $540. We held a retreat like this in 2007, it was in fucking Des Moines.
Is Deer Valley not one of the 99 Ooh, counties
look
in Iowa?
Nice that
looks nice.
Are there caucus goers looks that like hang out in Deer Valley?
Like, what are you doing out there? I mean,
also the fact that his fundraising, while, you know, it was decent, was heavily, heavily dependent on very, very wealthy donors.
Maxed out donors.
Who now can't give again. And now they're blowing through all of that money on private planes because the candidate and his wife prefer traveling on private planes and fancy hotels. But then later in the story, you find out in the New York Times that the candidate and his wife were also very surprised that they had spent that much money.
Yeah, I bet. I bet they were. How do they think they got to Deer Valley?
Yeah.
Hey, this Southwest flight is nice.
Wow, so well, I guess we got the A ticket. We go right to the A group.
We go right to the runway. That's neat.
Is that A group plus?
Yeah, that's cool. I will have a hot compress. Thank you.
And then you mentioned this too. I mean, he has like a super PAC with what, like $120 million that they're sitting on, but they can't even coordinate. Like, our campaign finance system is so broken and terrible. You're not allowed to coordinate, but they, with a super PAC, if you're a federal campaign, but everyone does it through like unofficial statements and memos and shit. And then DeSantis campaign put out a memo attacking the super PAC for not spending more money in New Hampshire, I believe.
Not putting any ads on the air up in New Hampshire.
And then it came out that the campaign manager freelanced and did that without telling the rest of the staff. Like, everything is leaking.
Well, the best thing is that not only did they not listen to the campaign memo, the super PAC did not get the memo, did not get the hint from the memo that said, we will not cede New Hampshire, which was a hint to them to go up on New Hampshire. They said, fuck you, we're not going to do it. Ron DeSantis did an interview with Fox where they asked him about his positive ads. And he's like, you know what? I don't control the super PAC, but pretty soon they should be lighting up the air with some real positive ads about me. They have not
done
that.
He said, I imagine they're going to be lighting up the airwaves pretty soon with a lot of good stuff about me. And that's going to give us a great lift. Since then, the super PAC has not aired a positive ad.
Or gone up in New Hampshire.
It's like, can you tell the super PAC that I'm mad at them? And the super is like, well, we know you're mad at us, but we don't care because we're going to do what we think is right. It's like, oh, well, can you just tell them that we heard that and we don't accept it? And we would really appreciate some positive ads.
It's just one more great quote from the campaign manager in a memo that we have to talk about. All DeSantis needs to drive news and win this primary is a mic and a crowd.
Yeah.
We need to hear Ron DeSantis more.
Meanwhile, Every one of those wackadoo videos.
Give him a mic in a crowd, and he's like,
the best ads are on DeSantis. You never hear his voice. The other, as part of one of these various reboot stories, I thought this statement from the spokesperson was revealing. The media and DC elites have already picked their candidates: Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Ron DeSantis has never been the favorite or the darling of the establishment, and he has won because of it every time.
He's literally, most of his fundraising was because like the richest part of the Republican establishment pitched in.
And it just goes to like, who do you think you're talking to? Who is going to buy into that argument? What Republican voter believes?
DC media elites love Donald Trump.
Yeah, what voter, what person that pays attention at all to any of this is like, ugh, I'm sick of these establishment candidates.
Yeah, that
like Donald Trump.
Andrew Romero, I think is the spokesman. It's like 12 different versions of the same Baghdad Bob quote. It's just absolute nonsense.
But it's just like, okay, you can do any reboot you want. Like, what is your argument?
Yeah.
Like, what argument are you changing? Because you've been out there for a long time.
Okay, what more do you want?
I didn't want to do a whole nother section on DeSantis today, but like, he's given us no choice.
No,
the reboot, shakeup, embarrassing stories, they just keep coming. We'll try to hold off on DeSantis for a while. We'll see.
Will we?
Well, we'll see. Well, maybe he won't make news.
The voters are.
Meanwhile, the Biden campaign's feeling confident, and they're building a somewhat unconventional operation to take on the Republican nominee. The Washington Post did a deep dive on what they're calling the hidden Biden campaign, which is a move to outsource a lot of their operation to the DNC, state parties, state organizations, outside groups. Politico reports that the Biden campaign is also feeling hopeful about flipping North Carolina for the first time since Obama did in 2008. And Axios notes that the Republican arguments against Biden on crime, immigration, and inflation are starting to crumble, even as the president's approval ratings are still stuck in the low 40s. Let's start with the Post story. The operation that it describes is very different from the campaigns we worked on. What do you make of the strategy?
I mean, it seems to me to be entirely driven by fundraising. We talked about this when Biden's fundraising numbers came out, but in 2014, the Supreme Court ruled that they changed campaign finance law that struck down limits on the aggregate amount a person could donate to federal candidates and to political party committees. So before that ruling, your donation to candidates, parties, and political committees was capped at $123,000. Now there's no limit. So if you can work through the DNC and other state and party organizations, you can go to big donors and say, hey, can you cut us a $900,000 check and raise a lot of money pretty fast that way, as opposed to raising $3,300 for the primary, $3,300 for the general, which is what you can get directly into Biden's presidential campaign itself. So it seems like that's why they're doing this. I think there's an obvious upside there. The risk is that sounds very challenging to coordinate to me.
Yeah, you'd need an incumbent of either party running for re-election is always basically going to control the DNC or the RNC, but the coordination has always been a bit of a challenge. Trump did this, though, in 2016 and 2020 with the RNC. The RNC basically ran the whole campaign. Yeah. Most of the staffers were there. Most of the field operation was run out of the RNC. You can I remember in 2012, even though we still had a big operation in Chicago, the DNC was still for all intents and purposes, working for the Obama campaign. So this is just now the DNC is basically under the Biden operation doing everything, polling, research, message testing. It's basically not separate. It's part of the campaign. And legally, all you need to do is to make sure whatever you're doing benefits Democrats and not just Biden. So anything that DNC does just has to throw in Democrats too, just for legal purposes.
Yeah. So, and you've seen that, you've seen ads like this, and this has been a part of campaigns for a while, because even before the limits were raised, you could still donate more to the DNC than you could to an individual campaign. And so a lot of times you'll see an ad and it will say, thanks to Joe Biden and the Democrats, we're investing in infrastructure. And that's an ad that can be paid for out of the DNC. So it seems like it's an extension of that and just trying to turn a bug into a feature, because one other piece of this that could be good for the long term is, instead of a campaign being stood up and then taken down, every 4 years, instead you could be building the infrastructure at the DNC, which could be used in future presidential campaigns and other campaigns.
Yeah, I think that's a good argument for it. I mean, look, historically speaking, the DNC has been at times very effective and at times very ineffective. And I think that's kind of the challenge is, when you start a campaign, you build it from scratch, you bring in all the leadership and all the staff and the culture. And sometimes it's harder to change the culture of a place that already exists. So that'll be that, and coordinating with these state campaigns. If every state party was like Wisconsin, we would win 50 states, but it's not.
The other piece of this too is Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, these were, people with long relationships with the broader Democratic Party. In 2008, Barack Obama is running an insurgent campaign, building his own organization, which mm-hmm. is a different thing. And so, yes, this works very well in a re-election bid for an incumbent Democratic president, but it'd be harder in future elections.
Yeah, well, and the only other thing we haven't mentioned is for an incumbent, the most important strategic decisions on a campaign still happen within the White House. So even though in 2012 we had a large sprawling organization in Chicago and all over the country, David Plouffe and Pfeiffer and everyone else were still in the White House. Yep. And legally there, you can work on the campaign in your free time. And also there are many functions which just aren't technically, one or the other. And so most of the high level strategic campaign decisions were still made in the White House consulting the campaign in Chicago.
The concept of free time in a White House job is very funny.
I know.
Also, federal campaigns, you get better rates on TV ads than super PACs do, for example. And that's actually a big advantage down the stretch when it's a really crowded ad market. So we'll see how they handle that.
What do you guys think of the argument that North Carolina could be the Arizona or Georgia of this cycle?
You mean a place that keeps me up at night? Sure. It's it. I'm in. I'm in on it.
I'd like to have one more state keeping me up at night. That just increases our odds.
Yeah, I know. I'm saying. Biden, roughly half the margin in 2020 in North Carolina. One fact about North Carolina, they added about, between 2016 and 2020, they added about 2 million new potential voters, both young people aging into the voting pool and people moving in from out of state. That has continued. And so every year, North Carolina starts to look a little bit more like, say, Virginia. Meanwhile, we are in a race to find states where we can win as things get harder and harder in some of the states we've talked about, like Ohio and other places like that.
Yeah, so Obama won North Carolina in 2008. Biden lost by 1.4% in 2020. I'm very much in favor of playing offense there. I mean, Roy Cooper is a popular governor. He can't run again, but he's a known quantity, and he can run around the state and make the case. North Carolina passed a 12-week abortion ban, which I suspect is very unpopular, and they might run a bona fide crazy person named Mark Robinson for governor. He's currently the lieutenant governor, and that might help. You're right, Lovett. There's been a lot of growth, population growth in urban and suburban areas that are favorable to Democrats. I did see some weird numbers about voter registration that were not good. Republicans have done better than Democrats in voter registration in North Carolina since 2020. So that ours have gained 6,000 voters while Democrats lost more than 175,000. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened there.
I don't either, but there is a trend with a lot of these southern states in voting registration where Democrats lose voters who are Republicans in every way but their party registration, and mm-hmm. they finally switch over, right?
Yeah,
there's the realignment there, but I should look into that. The interesting thing about 20 and Biden doing better in 20 than 16 is Trump had a much better electorate in North Carolina in 20 than he did in 16. There was a higher percentage of Republicans turned out. There was higher white turnout and higher rural turnout. And he still did worse than he did in 16 against Clinton. And that was mostly because of these Democratic gains in urban and suburban counties, which is where all the hope was always based in North Carolina, that the urban and suburban areas, the research triangle and everything, would just the population growth there would end up doing what happened in Georgia for Democrats. The Mark Robinson thing is also what I think Democrats are hoping for as a nominee, just because he is, you know, you mentioned the 12-week abortion ban. He's for a total abortion ban completely, and he's opposed to same-sex marriage.
He's a kook.
So he's a legitimate kook. And so these are all reasons why it could flip. The reason North Carolina is so tough and has been so tough, it is the second largest rural population in the United States, right behind Texas.
Yeah, and it's also really expensive. I did not realize it was the fourth most expensive state in terms of ad spend for Joe Biden at the end of the 2020 campaign.
Yeah.
$47 million.
It is expensive. And then in those rural counties, right, like Democrats are going to continue to get crushed, but if we get crushed less, then it's a huge deal. And Joe Biden in 20, a lot of the places that he won, he did less bad than Hillary Clinton did in some of these Trumpier rural counties. And, you know, we had Anderson Clayton on, who's the young chair of the Democratic Party in North Carolina. And this is why part of her strategy is just like visiting every single rural county, trying to find every Democrat there and registering them to vote.
But at this point in the campaign, you're going to tell reporters that you're going to compete 100% everywhere. But if we were giving the Biden team truth serum, I bet they'd admit that down the stretch, maybe you peel back some spending from Florida, which seems a little tougher, unless they get one of those ballot initiatives on. They're trying to get legalized marijuana and reverse the 6-week abortion ban. That would, I think, change the political calculus in Florida. But absent that, Florida is a tough state.
Yeah, and you'd want to.
Expensive.
I'd rather compete in North Carolina than Florida.
Yeah.
By a lot.
Let's listen to what Florida's been telling us.
they don't like us anymore.
Why do you think Biden's approval is still stuck in the low 40s, even though crime's down, border crossing's down, inflation's falling? Come on, isn't it morning in America? What's going on?
Let's just hope polling's a lagging indicator.
Yeah, that's possible. People are probably still not feeling the economic recovery from inflation just yet, I would say, too.
Yeah, the data is slowly trickling in. I mean, the hopeful answer is lagging indicator. There's all this good economic news. It'll take some time to seep in. The worrisome answer would be they have concerns about his age. For example, that's probably the thing you hear about the most from people in casual conversations. But
and that's not falling.
No,
that
number is not falling.
No, it's steady. It's rising steadily. The other piece of it too is, look, inflation coming down, very important. Inflation coming down doesn't suddenly make everything more affordable. It doesn't make things go back to how they felt in terms of how far your income could go 6 months or a year ago. It stops the pain.
Yeah.
Stops the change.
Yeah, and I also think just on approval ratings, like polarization now means just. It's hard to see a president getting consistently above mid-40s these days, even if your party supports you, because the other party does not in any way, not as much as they used to. You used to find like, you know, 10, 15, 20% of people in the other party who supported the president of the opposite party, and it's just not happening anymore.
It is, you know, and the idea that it's so polarized that basically Biden and Trump's approval rating both just hovered around 40. It's just, it's so... dispiriting.
Yeah.
But look, the fact that crime is falling board, like all these Republican tropes that they trotted out in the midterm and have for the last couple years, like I think it's worth the Biden people like telling a good story about this stuff, you know, that like that crime is down, that all that, you know, just because it whether it changes minds or not, like it certainly neutralizes an argument that you've heard all over Fox.
Right. Like whether you see it in the approval rating of Biden, that is a step removed from whether the arguments themselves are salient. And if the issues are not as powerful, then those arguments won't work as well.
And you want to start setting the mood music, right? And you want to, like, if you're the Biden campaign, the Democrats, you start telling a story that sort of makes people feel a little bit better, or at least tries to. All right, before we go to break, two quick housekeeping notes. The Crooked Store has some new merch. Check out our Bros for Row collection of tees and koozies. Perfect for all you self-identified bros who support abortion rights. Like, love it.
Yeah, I'm a bro for row.
You're a bro. I don't call myself a bro. I know you're like very bro-y.
Okay.
Yeah, you're the biggest
I'm
bro.
I'm the
us.
Biggest bro of the three of us, for sure.
Check out the Bros for Row collection at crooked.com/store. Also, If you haven't yet listened to Dreamtown, the story of Adelanto, you can now binge the entire series. It was named one of Vulture's best podcasts of 2023. The series covers the rise and fall of a small California desert city that was on the verge of collapse until a stranger came to town with a wild idea to make Adelanto great again, weed. It's got everything from greed and corruption to Mike Tyson and a Russian oligarch. Listen to Dreamtown, the story of Adelanto for free wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe to Crooked Subscription Community Friends of the Pod for ad-free episodes at crooked.com/friends. When we come back, Tommy talks to Congressman Dan Golden.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware.
Wayfair's biggest sale of the year is here. It's Way Day. Right now, you can score up to 80% off at Wayfair. Save on sofas and cookware, dining sets and rugs and beds, wall art, bar cards, floor lamps, ceiling fans, home decor, all things outdoor, and way more. All up to 80% off right now. Plus, everything ships free. And flash deals are launching all Way Day long. Don't miss Wayfair's biggest sale of the year. Shop Way Day right now, May 6th at Wayfair.com.
Style, every home. I'm Oren Siegel, and I've been fighting extremism, anti-Semitism, and hate for more than 20 years. You should subscribe to our podcast, Extremely, to get a unique perspective on the daily work and the people who have dedicated their lives to exposing, fighting, and disrupting extremism, anti-Semitism, and all forms of hate. We bring you the stories of people and communities not only impacted by hate, but who offer new perspectives and ways to push back. You can find Extremely wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dan Goldman is a member of Congress from New York and was the lead counsel during Donald Trump's first impeachment. Welcome to the show, Congressman.
Thanks so much for having me, Tommy.
Now, you're currently in a car, a little behind the music here. Where are you driving to?
I am driving around the district right now.
Nice.
Had a New York City, had a meeting with some 9/11 victims in Midtown, and on my way to Sunset Park for a community event.
Look at you. We're working every minute of the day, even in the car. So all of us news junkies out here, we're kind of waiting to see if and when Special Counsel Jack Smith will announce an indictment of President Trump for trying to steal the 2020 election. Folks might remember that. The January 6th committee in Congress spent a year and a half digging into this question and recommended specific criminal charges to the Department of Justice. You worked on Trump's first impeachment. You were also an assistant U.S. attorney for many years. What kind of evidence do you think Jack Smith could have that the January 6th committee was unable to surface?
That's a great question, and I think there will be a lot of new evidence. As you will recall, there were several witnesses who refused to show up and testify before Congress, and they will not be able to do that this time. And I think there are a lot of rumblings about whether or not someone like Mark Meadows, who did refuse to testify, is now cooperating with the Department of Justice at a minimum. We know that he has testified. And so people like that who were very close to Donald Trump will not be able to evade testifying as they were as part of the January 6th committee. The other thing that we know they've been able to get are records with attorneys. The a number of witnesses, or the January 6th committee, I should say, ran into roadblocks as it relates to attorney-client privilege and didn't have the time to litigate that. But the Department of Justice has a stronger position on and a better ability to get information when they pierce the attorney-client privilege because of the crime fraud exception. So I would expect to see a fair amount more evidence out of Jack Smith's investigation than we saw in the January 6th committee.
God, it's amazing that we could learn even more, even though we've learned a lot so far.
And not only that, we could learn more from people closer to Donald Trump.
Right, right. People who understand his frame of mind, things he was thinking and saying at the time in meetings, et cetera.
Exactly.
Talking about these cases is obviously complicated for President Biden, for the White House, for the campaign, because they don't want to make it seem like this is Joe Biden going after his political opponent. But members of Congress, other people in the Democratic Party are allowed to say whatever they want. Obviously, there's First Amendment still. What do you think is the best way for Democrats to communicate about these cases with the understanding that there is a presumption of innocence in this country?
Yeah, look, I think Democrats have been and will continue to be focused on buttressing our democratic institutions and the rule of law. And we've talked a lot over the last several years about Donald Trump's attacks on our democracy. And this forthcoming indictment may be the pièce de résistance of that, because of an effort to overthrow and overturn an election. But it is important for the court system to let the case play out. That is where the case should play out. Donald Trump is presumed innocent. He has a number of rights to confront witnesses, to a trial by jury, to see the evidence against him and to be able to respond to that evidence. And there is a tried and true process that occurs in a courtroom that allows our system of justice to play out. And that is where it should play out. It should not play out on a political campaign, and it should not play out in the halls of Congress. And so that's really at least what I've been focusing on, is let's let the system play out. Let's focus on what the allegations are and what the proof is. But the court of law is where this belongs, not the court of public opinion or Congress.
Yeah, if only he would exercise his right to remain silent. I mean, but the challenge remains that we're looking at trials that will likely start after most of the Republican nominating contests have already happened, potentially after the Republican convention officially nominates him, if Trump is able to delay the classified documents trial. I mean, how do you work with that as sort of the framework here where, yes, you're right that the courts are the proper place to adjudicate this, but voters might not have all the information they need to make a political decision before they have to vote?
Yeah, that's the quandary, is that there are political implications and ramifications to this. But just like Jack Smith, as the independent special counsel, takes an oath not to consider the political consequences or the political leanings of any case that he's involved in, he also is not worried about the electoral process. And it is frustrating, I think, for a lot of Americans who would like to see this process play out quicker, that it just takes time. And there's a reason why it takes time, but it is frustrating. And it may be very inconveniently timed for the political process. And we're going to have to figure our way around that.
So speaking of sort of solely political actors, Kevin McCarthy, according to Politico, is apparently supporting an effort, or has promised Donald Trump to support an effort, to expunge Trump's impeachments as part of some deal he cut for not coming out and endorsing Donald Trump in the Republican primary. McCarthy has since denied that there's some secret deal cooked up about these expungements. Have you heard anything about this? Do you think this vote will actually happen, and would it go well for Donald Trump?
I have heard about this. Marjorie Taylor Greene introduced one of them, and Elise Stefanik from New York introduced another one. I appreciate the fact that the Republicans recognize that the mark of impeachment is the political equivalent to a criminal record, which can be expunged. Unfortunately for them, there's no such thing in Congress, and they can do whatever they want, but it is a pure messaging exercise. There is no such thing as expunging an impeachment. And it would only just be a political talking point. He still would be twice impeached, regardless of whether or not it is expunged. But the broader political point, which you just raised, which I think is a good one, is it will put a lot of Republicans in a very bad position if they bring this to the floor. There are, as you well know, 18 Republicans in Biden districts, and that is not going to be helpful for them to have to support. And obviously, if they do not support it, they will bear the wrath of Donald Trump. So I'm very interested to see whether they bring it. I think it would be politically stupid for them to do so, but that hasn't stopped a lot of what they've done thus far.
You know, I don't think much of Kevin McCarthy as a leader or a person, but I do respect the fact that he negotiated a deal with Donald Trump where he gives him something that doesn't exist. That is, you know, that's good. Good negotiating. It's pretty impressive. Changing gears here. So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is unfortunately getting a lot of media attention lately by taking money from Republicans and then using it to pretend to run for the Democratic nomination for president. Last week, he appeared before the Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government, a committee on which you were lucky enough to be a member. Congrats. So the fact that RFK Jr. believes and spreads all these dangerous conspiracy theories has come up a lot. It's well known. I think less discussed, much to my frustration, is the fact that he seems to be literally a pathological liar. Like, he lies about everything all the time. You saw this firsthand. Like, how do you prepare for a hearing with someone like that? And why do you think Republicans wanted him there in the first place?
Well, the irony, of course, is he was ostensibly there because he wrote a tweet in early 2021, January 2021, where he said that Hank Aaron died because of the vaccine, when he had died from a heart attack. And there was, of course, no evidence at all that he died from the vaccine. And it was potentially very dangerous to tell many Americans that they can die from the vaccine. So the White House, someone in the White House sent an email to Twitter effectively saying, hey, can you take a look at this and begin the process of taking it down under your terms and policies? Mm-hmm. Twitter did not take the tweet down. So this was ostensibly a hearing on censorship, except, and he was brought in to talk about that, except he wasn't censored. So The irony of that is says all you need to know. So they essentially gave him a platform to spew his lies, to spew his conspiracy theories, with an idea of course, impugning Joe Biden, which is pretty much all they've tried to do with these investigations. I think my view of it is that he doesn't have any credibility. I thought it was shameful that they gave him the platform of a congressional hearing to spew his misinformation and to some extent his venom. You have a First Amendment right, but you do not have a First Amendment right to testify before Congress, nor is Congress required to give you that platform. And so no, I led a letter with Judy Chu, the president of KPAC, the Asian Pacific Islander Caucus, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's also on the Weaponization Subcommittee, to Speaker McCarthy and Chairman Jim Jordan to rescind the invitation. 102 people signed it in the span of about a day or two. And it just reflected, I think, the broad belief that this person does not warrant the platform of a congressional hearing. And I think that we saw a little bit of why that was last week.
Yeah, we sure did. Speaking of things we all wish we hadn't seen, Marjorie Taylor Greene made some news last week by holding up sexually explicit images of Hunter Biden at this Oversight Committee hearing. Hunter Biden has been very open about his struggles with addiction, including on this show. He recently pleaded guilty to 2 misdemeanor tax charges. It still is not at all clear to me, however, what the connection Republicans are trying to draw between Hunter Biden, his business dealings, and Joe Biden, besides the fact that they're related and this vague suggestion that Joe Biden somehow profited from whatever work Hunter Biden was doing. Can you help us understand those not like steeped in these hearings, what evidence has or has not been presented of such a connection, whether money exchanged hands, how you could hide that money from us, the public, when Joe Biden releases his tax returns every year? Like, what am I missing here?
You're not missing anything. And it's a very short answer, because there is none. There is nothing that connects Joe Biden to enter any of Hunter Biden's business dealings. And what ends up happening is that the Oversight Committee Chairman, James Comer, and others start talking about the Bidens, plural. and they start lumping Joe Biden in to their investigation, even though he's not on a single bank record. There's not a single wire transfer. There's not a single document that says that he was involved or benefited from any of it. And as I pointed out at our hearing last week, there's actually evidence to show that he was not involved and that clearly unfamiliar with the Chinese company CEFC, which Hunter Biden allegedly got money from. And he had no idea who they were, what they were doing, and was clearly not involved at all in Hunter's business dealings. And yet they continue to impugn the president falsely by alluding to evidence that does not exist.
So, I mean, is there just nothing we can do about it? I mean, basically, the Oversight Committee is going to hold these hearings. They're going to make specious allegations. And the best we can do is hope that members of Congress like yourself correct the facts in real time and that it gets covered.
Yeah, look, this is the political process that we're dealing with right now. I mean, when you see Marjorie Taylor Greene beclown herself by completely gratuitously and unnecessarily showing revenge porn during a congressional hearing, you learn everything you need to know about this Republican Party. I don't care what she was talking about. There is never a reason why you need to do that. And it was designed only to humiliate and embarrass Hunter Biden, who, as we all know, is a private citizen. He has never worked for the government. He does not work for the government, in direct contradiction to the former president's children. And the notion that that would be fair game for an official proceeding in Congress is despicable. But that's what we're dealing with. And ultimately, you know, you well know there is a political process. I would say that the ultimate accountability is at the ballot box, and that if people do object to the Republicans going forward with this kind of misinformation, personal attacks, and completely unnecessary and wasteful time and energy spent on investigations that have no connection to any official proceeding or any official purpose, then we should vote out Republicans. And if we can't vote out Chairman Comer because he's in a very safe red district or Marjorie Taylor Greene, we can vote out the rest of them and take over the majority. And then we won't have to deal with this absolute buffoonery that we're seeing.
Yeah. Final question. Speaking of buffoonery, what do you think about the suggestion that Democrats should bring posters of hardcore pornography to every hearing to kind of steal her thunder and make it less newsworthy? Is that something you're on board with?
I know you're joking. And
I made that up. Matt Gaetz would probably do it, I guess. You know.
Yeah, look, one of the things we are really trying to do is, and I'm focused very much on this since I'm on a couple of the investigative committees, is we're trying to bring a sober analysis of facts and truth, and that we're really emphasizing that we want to be the people that and the party that Americans can rely on to understand what is really going on. And I'm not going to sit here and defend Hunter Biden's tax issues, and he, to his credit, has accepted responsibility for them. And if there is a crime that anyone has committed, I believe they should be charged, Democrat or Republican. But when there isn't evidence to support allegations, and yet they continue to go on and talk about these allegations that have no basis in fact, that is unacceptable. And we will consistently point that out. And we will point out that they are wasting their time with these investigations that are going nowhere, rather than focusing on legislation that can help the American people. And that is the critical difference, I think, between Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, I suspect that even most Republicans who saw that hearing were confused and ashamed of the people they elected to go to Washington to represent them. But Congressman, thank you so much for doing the show. Good luck at your community meeting next. And thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much, Tommy. Great to be with you.
Thanks to Dan Goldman for joining us today. We'll talk to you guys soon, hopefully whenever we get an indictment. Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our producers are Andy Gardner-Bernstein and Olivia Martinez. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our sound engineer, with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Thanks to Hallie Kiefer, Madeline Herringer, Ari Schwartz, Andy Taft, and Justine Howe for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Mia Kelman, Ben Hefcoat, and David Tolles. Subscribe to Pod Save America on YouTube to catch full episodes, exclusive content, and other community events. Find us at youtube.com/@PodSaveAmerica.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware.
I'm Jessica Reeves, and I've been analyzing and reporting on extremism for the last 10 years, and I have the gray hair to prove it. Subscribe to our podcast, Extremely, for an always eye-opening look inside the daily work of exposing, fighting, and disrupting all facets of extremism. My co-host, Oren Siegel, and I explore this ever-changing landscape and bring you stories of people and places impacted by extremism, those who fight to protect our communities, and those who offer new perspectives. You can find Extremely wherever you listen to podcasts.